The 1981 baseball season was unlike any other before or since, but it had yet to be detailed in the form of a book, until Jeff Katz provided us with his work, aptly titled Split Season. Jeff not only has author credits, but is also the mayor of a little town in New York called Cooperstown. And Jeff, as is noted by the title, 1981 was split up due to a player strike, but the contentiousness between the players, represented by Marvin Miller, and the owners, headed by Commissioner Bowie Kuhn, festered throughout that previous season. Free agency was still in its infancy, and Kuhn was rankled about the shifting of power going to the players. How close, in fact, was a strike to happening even before the 81 season?
Well, as you alluded to, in 1980, there was a collective bargaining agreement that was expired, and the heat strike was averted really at the last minute. But within the 1980 settlement were the seeds of the 81 strike. There was one issue that was left on the table, and that was the issue of how, if any, compensation was going to be derived after a team losing a free agent. So the owners and the players had an agreement saying there will be a process on what was called direct compensation, meaning if a team lost a free agent, they could pick a quality major league player from the roster of the team that signed that free agent, almost like a trade. The process agreed upon said the owners could implement that direct compensation, but if they did implement it unilaterally, the players could strike. In the interim, there was set up something called a joint study committee where owners and players would perhaps hash out a mutually agreed upon compensation system, but that fell apart, which paved the way for the 81 strike.
Another major headline, speaking of free agents, another major headline prior to 1981 was the pursuit of Dave Winfield, once of the San Diego Padres and now, as I said, a free agent. The Braves, the Mets, the Yankees were among his most avid chasers during the offseason of 1980, the winter of 1980. He ultimately went to the Yankees, a 10-year, $15 million deal. But if you could, talk about the domino effect that it had on the team, especially its star player, a fellow outfielder, Reggie Jackson.
Yes, by the time Winfield became a free agent at the end of 1980, his relationship with the Padres had really soured. He came right out of college to the major leagues, was really the Padres' first homegrown superstar, but then he became a free agent. There was some sense that the Mets had a chance. That was a bit of a smokescreen. The Indians actually put in a pretty good fight for Winfield, but George Steinbrenner really wooed Winfield. He really courted him almost in a romantic sense, taking him to dinner, sending him flowers, telling him, you know, Dave, I can take you to these nice restaurants and I can't take Reggie there. So finally, the argument that won Winfield over was George saying, you know, it's time for you to be with a winner. What that did for Reggie was lead to a very complicated year. People who think of George Steinbrenner now, I'm 53 years old, so the George Steinbrenner I remember is kind of an insane sadist. The people who grew up in the late 90s and the early 00s, Steinbrenner was kind of an older, more stable owner of a winning team without controversy and kind of a lovable character on Seinfeld. But that wasn't true in 81. And while Reggie Jackson saw in the signing of Winfield leverage for his next big free agent contract, Reggie was going to be a free agent after 81, Steinbrenner saw it as a way to push Reggie out, which he eventually did at the end of 81.
Well, the season got underway on time and immediately got notoriety with the sudden emergence of Fernando Valenzuela, the 20-year-old rookie left-handed pitcher from Mexico, who won his first eight decisions and put the Los Angeles Dodgers at the top of the standings. He would go on to win both the Rookie of the Year and the Cy Young Award. How important was he not just to the fortunes of the Dodgers, but also to the strong Latin community in Los Angeles?
Fernando's an amazing story. He came up at the very end of the 1980 season, pitched part of a one-game playoff between the Dodgers and Astros, which the Astros won. But coming into the 1981 season, Fernando was slated to be be a starter at the bottom of the rotation. Through a series of injuries, he started opening day in L.A., shut out the Astros, and as you say, went on an incredible tear. He pitched 5 shutouts in his first 7 games. What it did for the Dodgers was really heal, at that time, an over 2-decade rift with its Latino community. When the Dodgers moved from Brooklyn to Los Angeles, it was clear that the site of their new ballpark with Chavez Ravine. While history has kind of always said that the Dodgers and the city ripped this Mexican community out of its area for the stadium, by the time the Dodgers were in play, the city had already kind of moved people from that neighborhood out. But it's a memorably ugly scene in those last moments where people were carried out by police to make room for the bulldozers. So the Dodgers never really had a strong Latino following in an area where the Latino population was growing and growing and growing. And similar to what the Dodgers did when they were in Brooklyn, which was always try to find a great Jewish player to tap into that audience, the Dodgers in Los Angeles always looked for a great Mexican player to tap into that audience. And then Fernando, they found not just an incredibly talented pitcher, but an incredibly charming and quirky figure.
1-1 to Guerrero. Ratcher comes back to his hitter, and there's a drive into deep left field. Back goes White. It's gone. Fernando, it's gone. What's going on here? The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all. The Fernando Valenzuela magic is alive and well. Who's to say when it will end?
Well, the strike happened. It was the first midseason strike in sports history, and it began on June 12th. The final tally on lost games would be over 700, I believe 712. When you think about 1981, you also have to think about, at least for my generation, 1994, and what took place that year with the eventual loss of the entire rest of the regular season and the postseason and the World Series. What was the likelihood to canceling the remainder of the season in 81?
It was ever likely. You know, what made the 81 season so fascinating to me is, unlike 94, which the season ended and kind of just it never came back, and going into 95, we all wondered if it would. But 81 has a beginning of the season, a strike, and an end of a season. The players always had a sense that the owners, who had taken out $50 million in strike insurance, because one of the things they pushed for in the 1980 settlement was to try to force the players into a strike in 81. They were very prepared for that. It is no coincidence that the strike ended just days before the owner's strike insurance ran out. So the players always felt that that would be the end of the strike. So I don't think anyone ever worried. They were more concerned about things like the All-Star game, which got pushed back, and would there be enough of a season to create a second half that had any merit. I don't think anyone thought the season would go to a demise and never come back.
I previously spoke with the author of a book on Marvin Miller, who is undoubtedly one of the most significant figures in baseball history. What were some of the most interesting anecdotes you discovered in your research of the negotiations between Miller and the owners, and especially the owner's negotiator?
Well, I think, you know, in my conversations with Miller, and I was fortunate enough that I started the research on split season at the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, when Miller was alive, so we had several conversations. What impressed me about Miller more than any specific anecdote was that here he was 27, 28 years after the fact, telling me accurate information that I could see from my contemporary notes lined up. And he was already like 90 years old. So just, you know, the comprehensive intelligence of the man, the insight. You know, I love his take on things, and I think that even though Miller, towards the end of his life, was seen as someone who was kind of off base, you know, he constantly fought from an outsider point of view the idea of the union participating in any drug testing and things like that, which made him seem out of touch. In reality, it was only him being true to form. He was always about worker rights. That was his background. That's what he brought to the major leagues. And that was always his pursuit. It was, you know, the money that came to the players afterwards was a natural follow through on his striving for better worker rights, but it wasn't primary focus. He didn't come to MLB saying, here's my goal to make sure that Ricky Porcello makes $20 million a year. You know, that's not how he operated. So I'm more impressed by kind of the quality of the man, his ability to make strides in a business that was so stuck in its ways, and in many ways still can be, was pretty phenomenal.
He faces Gary Carter. First pitch straightaway center field. Winfield going back, back, near the wall, back, leaps, can't get it. There's no indication. Now it's a home run, indicated by the second base umpire, Lou DeMuro. What a try by Dave Winfield, but Gary Carter has his second home run of the night, and it's a 4-3 ball game.
Both times, Carter has jumped on the first pitch. That ball may have landed right on the top of the fence and then bounced out. Carter, two first-pitch home runs as it just clears the fence.
Baseball resumed on August 9th, 1981 with the All-Star Game in Cleveland, with Gary Carter hitting two home runs, winning the game's MVP. The next day, the season officially restarted, and I believe on that night, Pete Rose surpassed Stan Musial as the National League's all-time hit leader. For those first few games back, maybe the first few weeks, I guess, what was the fan reaction and the fan turnout like?
The fan reaction was certainly negative, but baseball fans have always had a hard time not returning to the game. But attendance really saw a drop off, particularly in the American League. And what was really, I think, hard to create fan interest was the split season format, where, you know, teams that finished towards the bottom in the first half, even though they were given a clean slate in the second half, there wasn't necessarily enough time to develop true pennant races. Pennant races are organic things that kind of build and build and build, and the idea that in, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, all of a sudden you would have sellouts at Shea Stadium for a team that was at, you know, hovering around 500, two games out of first place, was not going to happen. So I think the owners missed the boat on how to resume the season. Had they resumed it in its entirety, sure, the cellar dwellers of the first half would have had an impossible time getting their fans to come back. But there ended up being, had the season played out in its entirety, really quality, true pennant races. And I think that was also a way that attendance could never regroup.
So the owners decided that the four division winners in each half would qualify for the playoffs, and in the first, so the first half AL East winner took on the second half AL East champ, and so on. The team that got jobbed the most through this was the Cincinnati Reds. They didn't finish in first place in the National League West in either half. The Dodgers and Astros were tops, but yet had the best overall record in baseball, and were still out of the postseason. You know, the Cardinals had the third best record, and they didn't win either half in the East, so they were out. Was there any movement from, you know, the Reds specifically themselves or the higher-ups to kind of maybe right this wrong and retract what the owners had originally drawn up?
Well, what's interesting about the Reds' vote, Dick Wagner, who was president of the Reds, during the discussion at the owners' meeting about how to resume the season, he saw the writing on the wall. He said, we finished close behind the Dodgers in the first half. What if we finish close behind the Astros in the second half? We won't make the playoffs. And he voted no on the split season format. much to his chagrin, I'm sure, it worked out exactly as he predicted. The team itself had disparate reactions. Manager John McNamara was really disgusted and aggravated about how it turned out. So was Ray Knight, the third baseman. But Tom Seaver, who I always admire and really respect for his intelligence and his way of talking, said, look, we had our chances. We still could have won. So, you know, a player like Seaver took it with some equanimity, but that wasn't true across the board to the Reds. And in their last game, they marched on the field with a big kind of pseudo pennant banner saying, you know, best record in baseball. So there were definitely some hurt feelings on the Reds side of this.
The makeshift playoffs instituted the division series, a best-of-five series between the first and second half winners of each division. The Yankees bested the Brewers for the AL East. The A's beat the Royals for the AL West. And it was the Dodgers coming back from down 0-2 to beat Houston to claim the National League West. And the Expos beat the Phillies for the National League East. Is there... I'm not sure about this. Is there any correlation between this version of the division series kind of being the impetus for what would occur in 95 and now what we see the national, you know, the division series today? Was what happened in 81 somewhat responsible for the future expansion of the playoffs, or is it simply because of the expansion of how many teams there were later on?
You know, I think there were people on the ownership side who saw possibilities in an extra round of playoffs. Interesting, Selig, but Selig as owner of the Brewers then liked the idea of an extra round of playoffs. Dewey Kuhn, the commissioner, did as well. There was in the existing national TV contracts an option to add a round of playoffs. Owners kind of knew that was in the mix, and by creating a second pennant winner, a second half winner, they could test that division series. What ended up happening was they were kind of a ratings flop, and NBC in particular was so disappointed in the ratings they weren't particularly clamoring for it again. In retrospect, the 81 split season may have delayed a third layer of playoffs until the mid-90s, had it been introduced and prepared for, and teams and their fans known there was a possibility of an extra round, it might have been more of an artistic success. The way it was just kind of cobbled together made it something of a catastrophe.
Making it out of the playoffs were the Los Angeles Dodgers, who beat the Expos on Rick Monday's famous home run in the ninth inning in the deciding fifth game for that LCS, and the New York Yankees, who swept Oakland. How important was it for Major League Baseball to have two regal franchises, the Dodgers and the Yankees, facing off after such a season of turmoil?
You know, it certainly helped. I mean, World Series ratings in 81 were a drop-off from 1980, which had two smaller markets. I mean, Kansas City, a much smaller market. Philadelphia, say, slightly smaller. Philadelphia is not a small market city. There's always something romantic and nice about a Yankee-Dodger World Series. It taps into so much history. That it worked out that way is kind of amazing, and it's the last time, actually until the Rangers played the Kings last year, the last time New York had faced L.A. in the finals of any sport. It kind of, you know, by being a Yankee-Dodger World Series, that can be a dominating idea. It kind of overshadows what the Dodgers did. The Dodgers came from behind in every one of those series to win. I think that team doesn't get as much credit for what it did to win a World Series, partially because of how scarring that year was.
Welch continues to throw in the Los Angeles bullpen. Watson hits it high in the air. For the center fielder, Ken Landreau, this should do it. The Dodgers are the 1981 champions of baseball.
And so there is not the usual noisemaking. It became apparent midway in the game, almost with the departure of Tommy John, that the Dodgers would take command.
Yeah, I mean, the Dodgers were down. They lost the first two at Yankee Stadium. Valenzuela pitched a complete game to win Game 3, and then they would win the next two at Dodger Stadium, then would wind up winning the last four games. They'd win Game 6 at Yankee Stadium to win the World Series, concluding, as we've all pointed out, a very strange and unusual baseball season. And also, because of 1994... it's one that gets very much overshadowed. Was that the main reason for you taking on this topic?
The 81 season always had real resonance for me. It could have been partially my age. I was 18, about to turn 19 that season. I was a passionate baseball fan, always was then, still I am to this day. But there's a passage Roger Angel once wrote about the 81 season, and he talked about the silence of that summer, how, you know, the side noise of baseball, people talking about it, radio, as you walk down city streets, you hear radio broadcasts of games as you're in cabs, and the way he wrote about it, and I'm no Roger Angel, believe me, no one is, but that always stuck with me, that image of this void in the middle of summer. And because 81 truly was this void that ended up getting filled and the game came back, it always stuck with me. Amazingly to me, there had never been a book about this. Not even like in 1983 did someone write about the 1981 strike. So, you know, sometimes they say, sometimes you want to write the book that you wish you could read. So that's about what I did. It was always a topic I was interested in. And then talking to some of the principals who were very involved in negotiations was really eye-opening and quite informative and entertaining.
Here's a brief postscript on 1981. Dave Winfield, who got just one hit in the World Series defeat, became the eventual scorner of Steinbrenner, despite putting up Hall of Fame numbers at the plate in his time with the Yankees. Fernando Valenzuela would go on to be one of the winningest pitchers of the 1980s. The Dodgers, meanwhile, would win the 1988 World Series and become the only team to capture multiple titles during the decade. And although the postseason didn't expand until 1995, the League Championship Series went from a best-of-five to a best-of-seven series beginning in 1985. Thanks to Jeff Katz for joining us. Thanks to all of you for tuning in to Baseball As It Was.